really a pleasure to be here, both at this university and in this city. And tonight what I want to do, if it's okay, is give a talk that you will be the first people to hear. And you know, usually think you get someone gives a talk, they package up something they've been giving 75 times before. But we're in very unique times right now in the United States. The economic meltdown, the depression, frankly, that we're in now, looks to be the defining moment of all our lives. And I suspect for the students at the University of Portland, the period we're entering right now will pretty much define your lives, much like the Great Depression or World War II defined your great-grandparents' or grandparents' lives or my parents' lives. That's the type of moment we're in. And in the middle of this crisis we're in, both political and economic, there is a crisis right now in journalism that's part of it that is every bit as important as the crisis of the economy. They go hand in hand, but they're distinct, and it's every bit as important. So what I want to do tonight is talk about that crisis, how to understand it, and what we can and must do in the coming months and years to address it, and the peril we face if we do not, and the peril is severe. First of all, and I think many of you are familiar with this, we're in the midst right now of extraordinary cutbacks in journalism, in traditional journalism as we know it. In the past year, roughly 16,000 journalists, paid journalists, working journalists in the United States with daily newspapers have lost their jobs. We're down to roughly 50,000 today. To 60,000, excuse me, and it's expected that we'll lose at least that many, if not more, this year. The number of people who are paid to do journalism today in the United States, or by the end of this year, to even be more graphic, who are paid to do journalism by the end of this year in the United States will be a small fraction of the number 25 or 30 years ago. But our population has increased, the amount of news that we need has increased. It's a severe problem. Newspapers, daily newspapers are closing down. It's almost a daily occurrence to see something in the news now about a newspaper that's considering closing or cutting back. Again, this is unprecedented in American history. We've never been in a situation with newspapers closing routinely, where we're gonna have areas in our country with no working journalists covering them any longer. Communities are voting on public office where there'll be no political information upon which citizens will be able to vote. As bad as the closings are, as bad as the layoffs are of journalists, newspapers that are closing, are just that those newspapers that are attempting to survive, those newsrooms that are attempting to survive, to do so are following the logic of cutting back, reducing the number of workers they have, closing down bureaus, so that what they have to offer is hardly attractive, and shedding readers who are for understandably saying, why should I pay money to read what exists in this newspaper? It's really sort of the funeral march or death dance of daily newspapers. Now, were this just an issue about daily newspapers that I was talking about, their decline and possible demise in the next year or two, with or severe retrenchment in the next year or two, that wouldn't be too severe of a crisis necessarily. Regrettably, though, we aren't just talking about daily newspapers, we're talking about the entirety of journalism as we know it in the United States. And let me just go through that. There was once a time, and anyone under the age of 40 will find this surprising news, that we had radio journalism in the United States on commercial radio that no longer exists. In the early 1970s, for example, if you were to go into a city like Washington, D.C., or any city of that size, any of the 20 largest cities in the United States, there probably would have been two dozen full-time working radio journalists just covering that community. That was standard issue, just radio. So if the mayor did something, if there was some big breaking story, two dozen radio journalists would be over there covering it, just in radio. We'll wipe them out, get the eraser out. They're all gone. There's no more commercial newscasting to speak of in this country on radio. Television news. You know, local television news now, like you just say that, it's like a joke. People start laughing. You don't have to say anything more. In this country today, now we're such a diverse country, there's so much, you know, there's people from so many different cultures and backgrounds, so many different interests. The one thing I found that unites all Americans, no matter where they're from, what their background is, everyone thinks their local TV news is the worst in the country. It's sort of our unifying thread nowadays in the United States. As for cable TV news or broadcast news at the national level, there's very little journalism there too. It's mostly punditry. People pontificating, oftentimes pointlessly, reinforcing the conventional wisdom and offering much heat, very little light. So there's not much journalism there too. And on television, when you do get journalism on it, it's usually when they bring a print journalist on to talk about some story the print journalist has done and report on it and give some insight. So with newspapers go, there's not anything at radio or television to compensate or make it up. Newspapers are really the main game. And then there's, of course, the internet. And the internet, of course, is the future of all media. We know that. We're in that process now. But at present, there's no indication that at this point in time, the internet is poised to replace what we're losing and provide sufficient journalism. Most of the stories that are linked to come from print originally. When those journalists stop collecting paychecks, those stories will stop being written, they'll stop being posted online. I love Wikipedia, I love the blogosphere. My wife thinks my head's been grafted onto a computer screen. But I have no illusions that that alone will not replace journalism. For social networking, for the internet to reach its promise of citizens' journalism, it has to work with a viable, strong journalism. It can't replace it. It has to have it as the basis for it to really help us improve and enhance our political culture. And it's not doing it yet. The efforts of old media, of newspapers to move to the internet, have been a process of trading old media dollars for new media pennies. It simply hasn't cut it. And there's no reason to think it will in the foreseeable future. So we're entering, as I said, uncharted waters, dangerous waters. Literally, we could be down to just a handful of journalists in community after community, in large parts of the country with no working journalists whatsoever. Huge state government with hardly any journalists covering it. Already we're down in most states where there used to be dozens of journalists covering the State House, just a handful are now covering it. With much more news going on, nonetheless fewer journalists. It's a deeply troubling time, and really the only people who can benefit by this, frankly, are corrupt politicians and the interests they serve. They're the only ones who benefit by operating entirely in the dark. For the rest of us, it's an absolute nightmare. And I'll stop here. I could do an entire talk on just what the dimensions of the nightmare would be if we lose all journalism. But just trust me, it's bad news. The more you think about it, the more depressing it becomes. So this is a high price, granted, $60 billion. And again, a year ago, if I'd made these suggestions, it would have been, people would have been laughing, throwing stuff at me, thinking I was deranged, clinically insane, laughing. Now this is perfectly sane, it's perfectly rational, because this is what it's going to take to solve the problem. Nothing else will work. Even when we're done with this, just this part, that's still not the end of the job. We've still got to come up with a long-term coherent plan to convert daily newspapers into viable, sustainable newsrooms for the long haul, and hopefully create a situation where we can have one, two, three such viable, sustaining newsrooms in the same community competing. And it's going to take public money, it's going to take imagination, and I think we've got to treat this as seriously as we treat things like climate change, as we treat pandemics, because it's that serious, it's that important for self-government. And I want to say one final word on why I think this isn't as absurd as it would seem otherwise. The times we're in politically are so radically different than any times in our lifetime. All the verities we've heard for the last 30, 40, 50 years can be thrown right out the window. Just the notion that we're talking about nationalizing the banks as we speak. Just the notion that they're spending trillions of dollars right now, the Federal Reserve, writing checks to banks over $1 trillion without really any news coverage of it. Ben Bernanke's doing this. That this is just, they're throwing money around that's unthinkable. And they're throwing it around because we're in a crisis that's really unimaginable. I don't think anyone really fully grasps the dimensions of it yet. But in moments like this, in crises like this, where the center isn't holding, where the status quo is failing, it gives us extraordinary opportunities. And we have an opportunity now, in this moment, to really democratize our society, to really make journalism something that can serve the role it needs to serve in a free society of engaging people, monitoring people in power, drawing some public life. But there's a downside too. In a crisis like this, it's not like there's only an upside. Really bad things can happen in crises like this too. And I'm an optimistic person by nature, so I'm the good cop here. I'm emphasizing all the great things that can happen. Understand that in the last moment historically in the world like the one we're going through right now, the 1930s and early 1940s, there was a range of different ways countries had dealt with their equivalent crisis that we're entering right now. In Sweden, in Norway, because their upper classes were entirely discredited during that period and they had very strong labor movements, they ended up, as a result of that, leapfrogging those countries from very backward countries to being countries with the least amount of inequality in the industrial world, universal health care, 90% unionization, the highest standard of living in the world. That's how they solved that critical juncture. The United States, we solved it by remaining democratic, by instituting labor unions with the Wagner Act, by Social Security, by a number of the things that are considered staples of American civilization today. Germany, well, they had a different way to deal with it. And make no mistake about it, no depression, no Hitler. That's the first rule of a German historian to tell you. It took the depression to create the political climate that made it possible for Hitler. And I don't think we want to go into a crisis of severe unemployment that's prolonged and severe stagnation that's prolonged and not have any journalism. I don't think we want to have every conspiracy nut go unchallenged with whatever cockamamie theory they come up with to try to explain the crisis we're in. I think that's not acceptable. So the battle for journalism has to be at the heart of the battle for social justice, for sanity, for solving the economic crisis, and solving the political crisis that really aided and abetted the economic crisis.
You've been listening to media scholar, historian, and founder of Free Press, Professor Robert McChesney. The title of his lecture is The Life or Death Struggle for Journalism and Self-Government. Robert McChesney spoke at the University of Portland campus in Portland, Oregon, on February 26, 2009. And now we return to the question and answer session from the presentation.
The question is, do I consider media deregulation an economic failure, or is this what it was intended all along, to sort of just make it short-term, make a lot of money and let it collapse? Well, I think the term media deregulation has always been a misnomer. Because deregulation implies, who doesn't like deregulation? Who wants to be regulated? Hey, deregulate me. I don't want anyone regulating me. But deregulation implies it's an open, anyone can have at it. Like when they say we're going to deregulate radio ownership, that's supposed to mean, okay, now I can start radio broadcasting. It's deregulated. Everyone gets a chance at it. But that's not what they mean by deregulation. Deregulation meant basically that one company could gobble up more of the monopoly licenses and make it a less competitive industry without any public service obligations for getting these monopoly licenses. That's just re-regulation for rich guys. That's not deregulation. That's a misuse of the English language. So we didn't have deregulation. We had re-regulation for rich guys. And this is probably true in other areas, but in terms of media, every time you hear the term deregulation, automatically just substitute re-regulation for rich guys, and you will have the truth of what's actually taking place. It's not a deregulation. It's not a free market or open market. It closes the market. If you think they deregulated radio, try broadcasting on some commercial signal. Say, hey, it's my turn now. It's deregulated. See how long it is till you're in a federal penitentiary. That's how deregulated it is.
The next member of the audience liked the idea of the three-year, $60 billion stimulus package for journalism, but asked how that might actually happen.
Well, I think what's going to have to happen is Free Press, the group I work with, and I'm no longer the president of it, I started it, I'm still on the board. Now I'm sort of their leading dissident. I'm sort of on the road trying to rabble-rouse to push them to take up this call. They're taking up the issue of journalism, but what we need to do is just make it clear to politicians, to whatever group we work in, how important this is to us. And we're working with the Newspaper Guild and working journalists. We're working with all sorts of organizations. The campaign's just starting. This is New Haven tonight. We're just sort of giving a test run on these ideas to see how they fly. But over the next 6 months or 9 months, it's going to be increasingly a campaign that grows. If you guys aren't signed up for the Free Press web, it's free to become a member to stay tuned in on stuff. Go to freepress.net. Do so. Is anyone here a member? Okay, do you ever get like emails for penis enlargement or from Nigeria to give you all your money? No, we don't give you any of that sort of stuff. It's very few emails. It's always selective. You aren't going to be bombarded. I'd urge you to do it. You can get out if you, for whatever reason, don't want to do it. But it's going to be a political campaign, and we've got to get all hands on deck. I mean, I think the way you win this fight is that you get all the groups that have crucial issues, political issues, labor in particular, environmentalists. We've all got a stake in this. You aren't going to win environmental fights if there's not journalism covering these issues, or labor fights. We aren't going to solve the economy without journalism. So everyone who's got an issue, I understand, we've got to have journalism in there. It's part of the answer. So we've got a lot of education and organizing work to do. The good news is that there's a lot of publicity about it right now. I mean, this is a really heavily talked about issue, and I think what I'm trying to do is just push the debate along. Because if we're going to spend a year asking if George Soros is going to bail out every newsroom in America, it's a year we're wasting in my life. And we don't have a year to waste right now, frankly. We got to get down to business right away. Questions about the fairness doctrine and where it stands today and how it fits into the future, present and future. The fairness doctrine was put in place in the late 1940s by the Federal Communications Commission, and it basically said to the radio and later television broadcasters of America, look, we're giving you a free license to monopoly spectrum, so you're going to become multimillionaires at the government's, thanks to us, by getting this monopoly license for a radio TV station. In exchange for that, we expect you to do two things. One, we expect you to cover important issues in your community, public affairs, to not just do junky sitcoms and crap like that. And two, when you do cover important issues in your community, public affairs, you present at least two viewpoints. You don't push one partisan agenda. Because unlike a newspaper, if you can start a new newspaper in theory, not in practice, in theory, if they don't like the viewpoints, radio and television, there's a strict number of stations in the community, and they can't add any on. That was the idea behind it. So, the problem with the fairness doctrine was that none of the stations paid any attention to it. The Part A part, they didn't cover their communities. I mean, what they do is they put on some public affairs show Sunday morning at 6:30 a.m., and they'd find the most boring person on earth to do it. I don't know where they found these guys. And of course, no one would ever watch them. And, you know, so they never did anything beyond that. And they claim, well, we'd do it if we could, if we didn't have to put two viewpoints on. So finally, the Reagan administration scrapped it. And oftentimes, that's attributed to the rise of right-wing talk radio, the Rush Limbaughs dominating the commercial airways. And today, I think for a lot of liberals and Democrats in particular, are saying, now let's put it back in so that all these radio stations will have to at least give Rachel Maddow a show next to Rush Limbaugh. It won't just be right-wingers. It's ironic because I'm not pushing for the return of the fairness doctrine. Free press isn't. No activist I know of is. None of us like it. The only people who are talking about it are Rush Limbaugh and the right-wingers who are using it for fundraising. They're going to their right-wing base and saying, look, these guys want to take us off the air. Give us your money. And that's all that's been going on with it, as far as I can tell. They're the ones who are making an issue out of it. And I'll tell you why the fairness doctrine is a non-starter to me. I don't like government involvement with content. I think enlightened policymaking minimizes that to the greatest possible extent. That, to me, is too much government involvement with content. I think the rational thing in a free society is set up a system where you'll have enough viewpoints around, you don't have to worry about stuff like that. If we had better ownership rules for radio, for example, I think we'd eliminate that problem right away. Part of the Rush Limbaugh problem came when they relaxed the ownership rules, so one company could own as many radio stations as it wanted in the country. Well, suddenly if Clear Channel or some other company owns 1,000 stations, well, it's easy enough to sign up Rush Limbaugh or Gordon Liddy to be on 300 of them. Radio, in my mind, there's no justification for allowing anyone to own more than one station at this point. And people would buy them in their own community. If you only own one, you aren't gonna, if you're in Portland, you're not going to buy one in San Antonio. You're going to buy one in Portland. So suddenly you'd have all the TV and radio stations in the community owned by local people. It's really a pleasure to be here, both at this university and in this city. And tonight what I want to do, if it's okay, is give a talk that you will be the first people to hear. And you know, usually think you get someone gives a talk, they package up something they've been giving 75 times before. But we're in very unique times right now in the United States. The economic meltdown, the depression, frankly, that we're in now, looks to be the defining moment of all our lives. And I suspect for the students at the University of Portland, the period we're entering right now will pretty much define your lives, much like the Great Depression or World War II defined your great-grandparents' or grandparents' lives or my parents' lives. That's the type of moment we're in. And in the middle of this crisis we're in, both political and economic, there's a crisis right now in journalism that's part of it that is every bit as important as the crisis of the economy. They go hand in hand, but they're distinct, and it's every bit as important. So what I want to do tonight is talk about that crisis, how to understand it, and what we can and must do in the coming months and years to address it, and the peril we face if we do not, and the peril is severe. First of all, and I think many of you are familiar with this, we're in the midst right now of extraordinary cutbacks in journalism, in traditional journalism as we know it. In the past year, roughly 16,000 journalists, paid journalists, working journalists in the United States with daily newspapers have lost their jobs. We're down to roughly 50,000 today. to 60,000, excuse me, and it's expected that we'll lose at least that many, if not more, this year. The number of people who are paid to do journalism today in the United States, or by the end of this year, to even be more graphic, who are paid to do journalism by the end of this year in the United States will be a small fraction of the number 25 or 30 years ago. But our population has increased, the amount of news that we need has increased. It's a severe problem. Newspapers, daily newspapers are closing down. It's almost a daily occurrence to see something in the news now about a newspaper that's considering closing or cutting back. Again, this is unprecedented in American history. We've never been in a situation with newspapers closing routinely, where we're going to have areas in our country with no working journalists covering them any longer. Communities are voting on public office where there'll be no political information upon which citizens will be able to vote. As bad as the closings are, as bad as the layoffs are of journalists, newspapers that are closing, are just that those newspapers that are attempting to survive, those newsrooms that are attempting to survive, to do so are following the logic of cutting back, reducing the number of workers they have, closing down bureaus, so that what they have to offer is hardly attractive and shedding readers who are for understandably saying, why should I pay money to read what exists in this newspaper? It's really sort of the funeral march or death dance of daily newspapers. Now, were this just an issue about daily newspapers that I was talking about, their decline and possible demise in the next year or two, with the, or severe retrenchment in the next year or two, that wouldn't be too severe of a crisis necessarily. Regrettably, though, we aren't just talking about daily newspapers. We're talking about the entirety of journalism as we know it in the United States. And let me just go through that. There was once a time, and anyone under the age of 40 will find this surprising news, that we had radio journalism in the United States on commercial radio that no longer exists. In the early 1970s, for example, if you were to go into a city like Washington, D.C., or any city of that size, any of the 20 largest cities in the United States, there probably would have been two dozen full-time working radio journalists just covering that community. That was standard issue, just radio. So if the mayor did something, if there was some big breaking story, two dozen radio journalists would be over there covering it, just in radio. Well, wipe them out, get the eraser out. They're all gone. There's no more commercial newscasting to speak of in this country on radio. Television news. You know, local television news now, like you just say that, it's like a joke. People start laughing. You don't have to say anything more. In this country today, you know, we're such a diverse country. There's so much, you know, there's all the, there's people from so many different cultures and backgrounds, so many different interests. The one thing I found that unites all Americans, no matter where they're from, what their background is, everyone thinks their local TV news is the worst in the country. It's sort of our unifying thread nowadays in the United States. As for cable TV news or broadcast news at the national level, there's very little journalism there too. It's mostly punditry, people pontificating, oftentimes pointlessly, reinforcing the conventional wisdom and offering much heat, very little light. So there's not much journalism there too. And on television, when you do get journalism on it, it's usually when they bring a print journalist on to talk about some story the print journalist has done and report on it and give some insight. So with newspapers go, there's not anything at radio or television to compensate or make it up. Newspapers are really the main game. And then there's, of course, the internet. And the internet, of course, is the future of all media. We know that, we're in that process now. But at present, there's no indication that at this point in time, the internet is poised to replace what we're losing and provide sufficient journalism. Most of the stories that are linked to come from print originally. When those journalists stop collecting paychecks, those stories will stop being written, they'll stop being posted online. I love Wikipedia, I love the blogosphere. My wife thinks my head's been grafted onto a computer screen. But I have no illusions that that alone will not replace journalism. For social networking, for the internet to reach its promise of citizens' journalism, it has to work with a viable, strong journalism. It can't replace it. It has to have it as the basis for it to really help us improve and enhance our political culture. And it's not doing it yet. The efforts of old media, of newspapers to move to the internet, have been a process of trading old media dollars for new media pennies. It simply hasn't cut it. And there's no reason to think it will in the foreseeable future. So we're entering, as I said, uncharted waters, dangerous waters. Literally, we could be down to just a handful of journalists in community after community, in large parts of the country with no working journalists whatsoever. Huge state government, with hardly any journalists covering it. Already we're down in most states where there used to be dozens of journalists covering the State House, just a handful are now covering it, with much more news going on, nonetheless fewer journalists. It's a deeply troubling time, and really the only people who can benefit by this, frankly, are corrupt politicians and the interests they serve. They're the only ones who benefit by operating entirely in the dark. For the rest of us, it's an absolute nightmare. And I'll stop here. I could do an entire talk on just what the dimensions of the nightmare would be if we lose all journalism. But just trust me, it's bad news. The more you think about it, the more depressing it becomes. So what's happened in the last 30 years is the limitations of professional journalism have been magnified by the corporatization, the conglomeratization, which has cut back on resources, cut back on the autonomy of the newsroom, encouraged the commercialization of content, and accentuated its problems. So the viewpoint that sees our crisis of journalism as just being that there's been a cutback in reporters, and if we just had more reporters, everything would be fine again, I think misses the boat tremendously. I think the starting point to really make sense of where we have to go is to acknowledge the plain truth. Our journalism today is deplorable, for the most part. It's dreadful. I think people are scared that young people aren't regular readers of our newspapers. I'd almost be more scared if they were regular readers of our newspapers. Certainly consumers of television news, for what passes for television news. I mean, let's go through some of the crucial issues of the last decade and look at how our journalism has handled them. Consider the coverage of labor or poor people. Poor people in our news media largely only matter when they get in the way of rich people. Other way, they're non-factors. They don't play a role whatsoever. In the United States in 1950, there were roughly 1,000 full-time labor editors and beat reporters in American daily newspapers. Nearly 1,000. Do you know how many there are? I won't say today because there are hardly reporters left, but you know how many there were 3 years ago? Less than five. Less than five. It's simply not a beat anymore. Instead, we have a business beat. And in our political coverage on television, the sort of opinion setters, what we see is an obsession with spin over substance at every turn. So we have real problems in River City. And I'd say the moral of the story for us is simply this. The corporate system is dead. The corporate community has decided journalism is a non-starter. They stripped it for parts. They're leaving it on the side of the road. They're moving on. If we want to create a better journalism, we're going to have to come up with a different system that actually is committed and will logically produce better journalism. And here's my argument, and this is probably where the most controversial thing I will say tonight, which is probably not saying quite a bit. I think the only solution to this, the only way we're going to solve the journalism crisis, is to understand it's going to take an extraordinary amount of government resources and subsidies to make it happen. There's no other way. It is the only way we're going to solve it, period. And let me take the next few minutes to explain why I make this claim. Now, the immediate response when you say that is, oh my God, that's unthinkable. That's anti-American. That's darkness at noon. You're calling for commissars to tell us what to think. How can you possibly suggest that? That goes against everything this country stands for, right? True? Are you with me? Yeah, you're nodding your head. But absolutely, I was in my crib at age 4 months, and I remember my father saying that to me. Freedom of the press means get out of the way of rich people. That's their, they get it. And you were very lucky to live in this country. 4 months old, I still remember that. And I understand the concern, not to be facetious. I think the concern with government censorship is supremely important and inviolable. It's an extraordinarily legitimate issue. But I think the way that it's presented and why I was being facetious is it's not meant to really engage in a legitimate debate on that issue and understand the principle involved, but it's meant to prevent a legitimate debate, to prevent understanding the real important principles that's involved. And I'd like to do now is explain a better way to understand the role of government in a free press, a more accurate way and a much more democratic way. First of all, government involvement isn't anti-American. It's quintessentially American. And this is where a little American history comes into order for all of us. If you look at the founding of the Republic, it was an obsession of the founders in the early Republic that we have a free press. Jefferson and Madison in particular, and I've been, as a scholar, at times been quite critical of both of them, especially Madison and some of their views. But when it comes to issues of freedom of the press, I have to give them high marks. These guys absolutely knocked it out of the park. They understood it in their bone marrow. that if you were going to have a constitutional system with self-government, where people govern their own lives, you could not have it unless citizens knew what was going on, unless they were informed. You could not have self-government, and you could not have citizens informed without a free press, a press system. That was the starting point for them. That wasn't like, let's debate whether we need a press. It was, we have to have a press. And my books are filled with pages and pages of their quotes on this very point, the most famous of which we use as a title, John Nichols and I, for one of our books, where Madison just said, basically, in frustration with some knucklehead who didn't quite get it, said, if you don't have a viable press system, you can't have self-government. What you'll have will be a tragedy or a farce, as a famous quote, but it will not be anything close to self-government. You have to have a sustainable, viable press system. So the first job of the government, was to make sure you had a free press, or else the whole Constitution doesn't work. That's how they understood it. And this is where the history is so important. If you look back at the founders, this wasn't just some public relations spin they cooked up to satisfy people 200 years later. They walked the walk. What did they do? What did the founders do? Well, for starters, how seriously did they take the role of the state in creating a free press? They made it a rule that for a territory to become a new state in the United States, it had to have a certain number of newspapers. Because unless it had a certain number of newspapers per citizens, the people wouldn't be capable of self-government. So you couldn't even become a state until you had enough media so you understood what was going on in your state. That was how important it was. That just scratches the surface. The post office, for much of its history, well into the 20th century's first and most important job was as the distribution arm for newspapers and periodicals. And prior to about the 1830s, all newspapers were distributed almost entirely by the post office. 90% of the traffic of the post office in the 1830s was daily newspapers or weekly newspapers. 90% of the traffic. And one of the great, it's in the Constitution that the Congress has to set up a post office. And one of the great debates in American history was in 1792 in the U.S. Congress when they were debating with this post office they set up, what are they going to charge newspapers to be distributed? Now today, of course, we would think that, of course, in 1792, members of the House and Senate took turns standing at the gavel, slamming their fist on the table and saying, full rate, no free lunch. These guys have to pay the full amount. This is a free market. We can't have any welfare cases in this country. Of course, we assume they were waving copies of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and just trying to trump each other in their beloved praise of the free market. Right? Of course. This is America. That's what we were raised in. Right?
Right.
Not quite. This was the range of debate in 1792 on postal subsidies, postal prices for newspapers. At one extreme position was the position that they should be heavily subsidized. The cost of mailing newspapers would be much less than the cost of mailing anything else. The government, the people of the country, through the government, should take it upon themselves to heavily subsidize it to encourage more newspapers, because that was such a huge cost for a newspaper. That was one extreme position. The other extreme position, that of James Madison, that of Benjamin Bache, the grandson of Ben Franklin, one of the leading newspaper publishers today, was that all magazines, all newspapers at all times should always be free. Any charge for distribution was a form of censorship, because the most vulnerable publications, the most controversial ones, are the first ones that go out of business if you charge anything for distribution. So that was the range of debate. That's how they viewed the post office. That became the largest indirect subsidy or direct subsidy in American history before the Pentagon came into existence, was doing newspaper distribution. That's how serious this was. That range of debate continued for the next 100 years in Congress. It was a public debate. One of the real victories over postal subsidies came, this side won initially. It was heavily subsidized. They didn't get the free. But they kept fighting it. And finally, by the 1840s, one of the great victories came when the abolitionists were able to get weekly publications, free postage, in their own county. And these were all the abolitionist papers, the smallest papers. They could finally stay in business because they didn't have to pay for postage anymore in their own county. It was a major victory for the abolitionist movement. So these were serious political implications to those debates. And they were understood that way. They weren't just protecting a powerful industry here or there. And to give some sense of the extent of the subsidy, 90% of the traffic in 1830 of the post office was newspapers. It accounted for 2% of the post office revenues. That's a serious subsidy. 10% of the traffic did 98% of the revenues, 90%, 2%. That's a serious subsidy. They wanted to encourage people to have wide variety of viewpoints. And you know why it was brilliant and enlightened policymaking? Because look at those subsidies. That postal subsidy didn't favor one political party over another, didn't favor one viewpoint over another. Everyone could play. Abolitionists could play, slaveholders could play. It just made it possible for more voices to be heard, for journalism to prosper, to create a culture where people would be engaged with social life. All those subsidies that. And when we talk about government involvement, that's what we're talking about, those sort of subsidies. We're not talking about hiring someone to go in and kick Rush Limbaugh's ass and replace him with someone else. Not that, you know, but that's not what we're talking about. That's not what we're talking about. We'll let Rush stay there. That's fine. But he's just not going to be the only voice in town. That's the point. There'll be other voices heard as well. You know, this point, I want to close this. It's such an important point. The U.S. Supreme Court, interestingly enough, has not really considered freedom of the press issues that much in its history. For every freedom of the press case that's gone in the First Amendment before the U.S. Supreme Court, there have probably been 10 or 12 freedom of speech cases. And in most people, and oftentimes I think they conflate the two. They think freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the same thing. You know, if you have the right to stand up in a corner and yell, it's the same thing as having the right to publish a newspaper or a magazine. Well, they aren't the same thing. It's why they're two separate entries in the First Amendment. Because freedom of the press is a very different phenomenon. It serves a different role than freedom of the speech. And when the Supreme Court has actually specifically looked at freedom of the press, it said some extraordinary things about what the government's role is with regard to our press system. Consider First Amendment absolutist Hugo Black, probably the most famous civil libertarian in the Supreme Court history. In one of his most famous decisions, Associated Press versus the United States in 1945, a decision basically when Associated Press and private media companies said the government couldn't regulate them and use antitrust law to break up monopolies because that would violate their First Amendment rights. Hugo Black slapped that baby down, and in the majority opinion, one of the great opinions in American Supreme Court history, he wrote this: "The First Amendment rests on the assumption that the widest possible dissemination of information from diverse and antagonistic sources is essential to the welfare of the public, that a free press is a condition of a free society." And in the piece, he argues the role of the government is to make sure that free press exists. Otherwise, you cannot have a free society. All our freedoms are lost. Now, you might say, oh, that Hugo Black, he was one of those left-wing guys from way back in the old days who didn't really understand how modern societies work. Well, how's this for you then? The most recent case in Supreme Freedom of the Press Supreme Court, the opinion of Reagan appointee Justice Anthony Kennedy from 1994. Quote, "Assuring the public has access to a multiplicity of information sources is a governmental purpose of the highest order." A governmental purpose of the highest order. And I think that if you want to stand back now, what people will eventually see about the moment we're in now is that the period in which we could trust capitalists to run our journalism and let them have it, which for better or for worse, and there's been better and there's been worse, it's been a mixed bag, but that period is an anomaly. You know, that started in the 1830s or 1840s, and it's ending now. That hasn't been the permanent period. That wasn't the case in 1791 or 1805 or 1820, and it's not the case in 2008 and going forward. It was an anomaly. So we got suckered into thinking, yeah, we could always trust the Wall Street guys to handle journalism for us. They got it wired. Well, now we know they did it. They made a lot of money on it. They stripped it for parts. They took the car, left it on the side of the road, and they were moving on, hopefully to jail, some of them. And we're left, though, dealing with the fact that we don't have much journalism. Now what are we going to do about it? The ball's in our court at this point. Another point I would make that's often misunderstood about our media system is we don't have a free market system. Our media system is nothing close to a free market system. It's built on some, still, not just postal subsidies, but enormous direct and indirect subsidies and government monopoly licenses. We don't have a free market that the winners are those that best serve the public. We have a system where the government basically sets the terms that picks the winners that do the competing. Consider radio and television. The government gives monopoly licenses to radio and TV channels for the last 60, 70, 80 years for free to companies. They're inordinately valuable. And then these same companies can sell the licenses and make the profits off of them. We don't get a penny from it. That's an enormous subsidy that we've been giving to radio and television broadcasters, creating very uncompetitive markets in city after city after city. Monopoly licenses to satellite, cable television systems, telephone systems, those are all monopoly licenses, all of them. And even where they've opened up the markets, yeah, how many cable television systems do you have of choice now? How many legitimate phone systems do you have choice? Very, very few. Usually, at best, you have a duopoly. And as any economist who studies microeconomic theory will tell you, a duopoly basically operates the same as a monopoly in terms of price and content for users. There's no real difference. Just you have two people rather than one. So that's the truth of our system. The question isn't whether we're going to have subsidies and policies. We're going to have them, and I'm going to argue strongly we need them. The question is who we're going to have them for, how they're going to be determined, and to what effect. I think the key problem we've had in the United States is those policies and subsidies in recent years have been determined corruptly, behind closed doors, secretively, to benefit the phone companies, the cable companies, the satellite companies, the broadcasters, not to benefit us. And we've got to expose these processes, get involved with them, take them over, and demand policies and subsidies that serve our interests, that serve the interests of democracy and of journalism. What I think we need to do, and listen carefully to my plans, because you can see there's no government commissar in any of this stuff. There's no darkness at noon. Listen, you know, I'm more concerned about the government than anyone, and these guys, anyone in this room. I mean, I've been criticizing Republicans and Democrats for 30 years. They're going to start locking people up. I'm at the front of the parade, so believe me, I'm not interested in letting government lock anyone up. Let's get that clear. What we need is a three-year, $60 billion stimulus, $20 billion a year for journalism. And this is what it would entail. 3 years. For magazines, any magazine in the country that has less than 25% ads, free postage, distributed for free. Any magazine, whatever you're doing. So the Klan magazine gets it, the revolutionary communist guy get it. Everyone in between. Whatever your content is, it doesn't matter. Less than 25% ads, free postage. That will keep a lot of publications alive that right now are about to go under because postage is such a serious cost for these publications. And those are all going to have websites too. They're going to be putting material up for web. These are the things that get linked on the Huffington Post and Daily Coast that you're reading, come for a lot of times from these publications. They're breaking stories no one else is covering. Secondly, for every citizen in the country, you can take $200 off your taxes, not on your taxable income, but your taxes, and use it to subscribe to a daily newspaper. Any daily newspaper of your choice. Basically, the government's going to buy you a subscription to a daily newspaper. If you want it. And if you don't want it, you don't have to use it. You say, thanks, I'd rather pay the government. I don't want to read a daily newspaper. It's your choice. You can pick whichever one you want. Doesn't matter. You can subscribe to any paper up to $200, government will cover it. This will give our daily newspaper, as long as they've got a, the only criteria I'd say is they've got to publish at least 5 times a week, no more than 40% ads, and at least 24 pages. So we can't someone scam this, you know, on some bunko scheme. But this would buy our newspapers 3 years to start to get their act together, try to make a segue, keep a lot of journalists working and a lot of communities who wouldn't have jobs otherwise. And I think a lot of people would do it. It would cost a lot of money, well worth it. We can't afford to lose another 30,000 journalists in the next year, year and a half, which is what we're looking at right now. Third, one of the real crises we have in journalism has been young people are not involved with media enough, with journalism enough. They've lost a connection to it. I think the government should say that any middle school, high school, college, university, community college that wants to have a weekly, even daily student newspaper, government will foot the bill if they want to participate. Get students doing media again. Get journalism alive in our schools again. You know, there's a study that was done by the Pew Foundation or the Knight Foundation that showed that students who actually did journalism in school newspapers had a much richer appreciation of all our freedoms than students who didn't. They really sort of understood the importance of freedom of speech, freedom of religion. And the students who had no connection to journalism in student media, the percentages were much lower. It was a frightening survey. I think we had to get people immersed in doing media, in doing journalism. Duke Ellington, the great musician, had a taxonomy for music. He said there's two types of music. There's good music, and then there's the other stuff. Well, that's how journalism is. There's good journalism, and then there's the other stuff. And until we get a lot of people doing it, the other stuff is too prevalent. And I think one of the complaints journalists have is that today you can get away with doing mediocre stuff a lot more than you used to because you don't have a market of readers who's as critical as they used to be because they're not used to the good stuff. And until we get people doing it, we aren't going to have the good stuff. Now, all that stuff I just talked about, there's no darkness at noon, all that stuff's going to be online. So we'll be filling up cyberspace in the digital realm with all sorts of great material from these subsidies right away for the next 3 years. And here comes the most important one. This is actually the suburbs. Now we're going to get downtown. We've got to ramp up our public and community media. We've got to seriously ramp up immediately our public and community media. And notice I say media, not broadcasting. So I'm talking about what we think of as broadcasting. But all public and community broadcasting has a web presence, and that's going to increasingly become their identity over time. So we might as well start calling them public media. Let me give you some figures that I think will astound you. They certainly astounded me when I saw them. Compared to the United States, spending per capita on public media, public and community radio and television stations, you know how much Canada spends per capita more than we do? United States? 16 times more. You know how much Germany spends more than us? 20 times. Japan? 43 times. 43 times. 43 times. Britain? 60 times. And here you go. Those dungeons where those gulags of Scandinavia, Finland and Denmark, you know how much more they spend per capita on public media than we do? 75 times. 75 times. And you know, my wife's Norwegian. I go back to Norway quite often, and I listen to incomprehensible Norwegian media with her all the time. And what's striking, though, is every community in Norway has public radio journalists covering their little, tall, small town. There's just tons of radio journalists because they have so much resources. And they're great. There's no ads. I mean, it's real journalism. It's really covering their communities. There's no reason we can't have that. Why do we have to be such paupers? Why can't we, you know how much we spent on public media this year, what our budget is? $450 million. Now, that sounds like big money, right? $450 million, but it isn't. We should be spending $10 billion minimum. That should be the starting point. And that money should all go to be hiring journalists, out-of-work journalists. Get them to work right now in community after community that has no coverage anymore in small towns in this country that might have a public or community station. Get some journalists back to work, covering it. Get journalism alive and well. You know, give some sense of our priorities. We spend roughly 10 times more than what we spend in public media for Pentagon public relations to convince us that the wars we all oppose are good wars. So we're spending 10 times as much on Pentagon PR than we are on public media in the United States today. That's got to change. That's absurd.